Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. Our guest today is Bernardo Sorge. Bernardo is a Brazilian social scientist, retired professor of sociology at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro. He is director of the Edelstein Center for Social Research and of the Plataforma Democrática project. He has published 30 books and more than 100 articles on Latin American political development, international relations, the social impact of new technologies, social theory and Judaism, and in 2005 was elected Brazil's Man of Ideas. He's here to talk to us today about humanism without hubris. Hello, Bernardo. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hello, Barry. Thank you for the invitation.
You're welcome. Well, I'd like to start, if you don't mind, Bernardo, by reading an extract from a text you wrote for your email list and your social network for the Jewish Passover Festival, which I feel has a lot of resonance with the Middle Way.
Please, help yourself.
Okay. You say that living is a constant struggle between freedom and slavery, between freedom that leaves us vulnerable and our desire for security that limits our freedom. Passover or Pesach reminds us that life is a journey between the expectations of others and acting according to what we believe is right or wrong, between the fear of discovering ideas and experiences that may change us and the curiosity that transforms us, between the insecurity that does not let us acknowledge our limitations and the irony that keeps us from taking ourselves too seriously, between suspicion of the unknown and the curiosity that transforms us, between traumatic fixation and the power to overcome, between outward showcases and the inner life, between complaint and action, between dogmatism and openness to the opinions of others, between having and being, between contemplation and possession, between wanting it all and being satisfied with what we have, between the excessive and the essential, between imposition and dialogue, between speaking and listening, between a past that oppresses us and a past that teaches us. In Passover, we learn that the oppressor suffers from delusions of grandeur. He dominates and controls others to impose his will, forcing them to conform to his desires. But as human beings, we are finite and mortal. And because we are finite and mortal, we live in uncertainty. And because we're finite and mortal, we feel afraid, insecure, and emotionally needy. And because we're finite and mortal, the other is a source of learning and support. And as Jews, we must also always remember that we were persecuted and must never persecute, that we were humiliated and must never humiliate, that we were stigmatized and must never stigmatize, that we were oppressed and must never oppress, that we were confined in ghettos and that no one should have to live in slums, that every form of slavery ends in a struggle for freedom. I just think that's wonderful, Bernardo. Would you say this in many ways encapsulates what you mean by a humanism without hubris?
That's the point, because I think some versions of humanism tend to put human in place of God. I think that the issue if God exists or not, personally I don't believe in God, is something that should not be confused with the deep idea of humanism, that is, we are not gods. We don't think ourselves that by banishing God, we became gods. The idea for me, the deep idea for humanism, is to recognize the specific human condition, our limitations. And in fact, in this sense, I am really critical of some religious version of God that people, by using the idea of God, becomes gods.
Yeah.
And I think a deep religious person, which I respect, although I do not share, understood that he's a human being with all the limitations as a human being, and God is a different entity. In some dogmatic versions of religion, people use God to become themselves God, a level of hubris that is present in different degrees in religious people, but sometimes also in non-religious people. In this sense, I want to differentiate myself from some religious and non-religious versions that speak about human being, but with a level of hubris that in fact are unhuman or produce unhuman consequences.
Sure. Okay. Well, I suppose humanism is often associated with atheism. Now, you say you don't believe in God. I suppose for me, I express my slightly different. I suppose I would say I hold no belief in God. And looking at this text, at least, you talk about the recognition of uncertainty and of our finite nature. Doesn't that apply agnostic stance rather than an atheistic stance?
I agree with you. We live within cultures. In a culture that God doesn't exist, let's say that people don't have the idea of God, you are not atheist.
Yeah.
Because even the idea of atheism doesn't make sense. You, or some people sometimes, they call themselves atheists in relation to a culture that wants to impose or disseminate the idea of God, and then you differentiate from them. But I agree with you, it's not a good definition, because atheism defines itself in relation to God. I personally don't define myself in relation to God.
Yeah.
I think, first of all, I think that at least in Western society, both Islam, Christianity, and Judaism are not really theisms. The base of their belief is not God. They believe in Moses and Muhammad, in Jesus. They believe in particular individuals that represent God or receive the mandate from God. Mm-hmm. In this sense, I would say that at least Western, or not only Western, because Western is a very limited geographical space, let's say Middle Eastern, to be more specific, by origin, religions, they're not really theistic religions. They are homotheistic religions. They believe that a specific human being had a mandate from God.
Yeah.
If you think about theism as a pure idea of believing at the God that eventually created the universe, like Albert Einstein, has nothing to do with this so-called religious perspective.
So, I mean, it's a very complex term, religion, but what does it mean to you, religion? And how would you describe your own personal relationship with Judaism?
Two excellent and difficult questions. Religion, in fact, is what we call today contested fields. There are so many definitions, and none of them really convincing, because in Western society, when we speak about religion, we speak about God, basically. And in fact, we know that Buddhism, for instance, that people define as religion, has no God as part of the beliefs. Then I think you have two alternatives. Or you define religion in a very Western-centric way, you know, by religion you define people that believe in metaphysical entities, one of them can be God or a different one, or you define it, which I also accept, in a more wide sense of some feelings that goes beyond what you can call rational argument or things you can put in words.
Yeah.
You can say that when you hear Beethoven, you have a religious experience,
yeah,
for instance. Is something that is overwhelming feeling, or which some people will call it mystical.
Yeah.
But in this sense, I think it is not a problem for me that somebody prefers to define religion in this very wide sense, and then, of course, everybody is religious. In some moment of their life, you can have overwhelming experience about the universe, about whatever, that cannot be defined in words. And fair enough. But it doesn't help when we try to have a more rigorous debate. And then religion, I think we should use it, at least in normal parlance, basically about organized religions, institutionalized religions with clear structures of what is true and untrue and so on. In this sense, I am not religious. And then about Judaism. For me, in my childhood, Judaism was a religion.
Because
it's important, and I was reading the Middle East Society materials, which I, most of it, if not all of it, I tend to agree. But it is important always to remember that individuals are a permanent process of making.
Definitely.
It is, we begin by not being individuals. We don't choose where we are born. We receive a lot of inputs from our family, from our school, from our friends, from the country we live in, and so on.
Yeah.
Then individual is something, in fact, is a permanent interaction with an exterior, which is very important, which is called culture. And of course, I am Jewish in the sense that for me, Judaism was very important in my formative years. The experience of having a father and mother that transmitted ideas of history, of values, of a group trying to survive against the odds. And in this sense, I feel Jewish. But I don't feel Jewish in the sense that for me, Judaism is the only cultural reference, or even normally not the most important. I feel more related to science than to the Bible.
For instance,
I feel that scientific thinking, or I like klezmer music, or when you go to a synagogue and I hear some music that reminds me my childhood, but of course I prefer classical music.
Yeah.
And I think that culture where you are born, you are English, American, and so on, and you are part of the values of the culture, which are basic for you. I came to non-religious belief through Judaism. When I was 13 years old, my father lost all his family in the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And it was very traumatic, as you can imagine. And when I was 13 years old, I said, Daddy, he was a very human person. Really.
Yeah.
Daddy, sit down. Yes, what you want to tell me? I said, God doesn't exist. If there was Holocaust, God can't exist.
Yeah.
And my father began to cry and said, Baruch, which is my Hebrew name,
yeah,
Bernardo, I have no arguments. I continue with the religious tradition for respect of my father. He was a rabbi, his father.
Right.
But I have no arguments. Then you can say, a Jewish atheist, I came to my non-belief in God through Judaism.
Now, very interesting. Yeah.
I think each person comes to, it's not a pure logical, rational feeling. It's related to what he was being taught, what God is, and then you relate to that, and then you find your own way. And then I read a lot of Buddhist literature, which I was always very impressed.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm not part of the Buddhist culture in the sense of everyday life and experience. For me, it's more an intellectual element than I can't define myself really as Buddhist, although I have a greatest respect for Buddhism.
On that point, I think that relates to my own experience, because I wouldn't describe myself as a Buddhist either, but I do remember being very influenced by a guy called Stephen Batchelor, who talking about religion, and he said that the religious sensibility, for him at least, is coming to terms with our existential condition. And what's critical here is not positing any final answers, but literally reconciling oneself with the fact that we're born and that we die, etc. And that's something I can feel comfortable with. In that sense, I could comfortably describe myself as religious.
I share with you your feeling, although to be honest, there is still in myself a childish feeling of anger with the fact that God doesn't exist. to be honest, in this sense, I am atheist.
Yeah.
In the sense that there is really still my feeling of a child which believes strongly in God and suddenly understood that such entity doesn't exist, produced me a feeling of anger,
yeah,
which I need still to elaborate to have this more peaceful feeling that we are what we are and we need to accept. I must say that also in deep in myself, at least so far, because I hope to change, I don't think that there is nothing else other than life. You are born and then you die, and that's that.
Mm-hmm.
I have no any feeling of transcendence.
Yeah.
And I don't think that makes any sense. In this sense, in the Buddhist sense, that individuality has any sense other than in this world, in our societies, that if there is something beyond, of course, are not individuals. And therefore, my self-individualistic sense will disappear. Yeah. On that, I say I'm almost sure.
Yeah. Well, I would agree with you to a large extent there. I'm very doubtful that things go on beyond this lifespan. But I don't ultimately know. And to be honest, I don't get hung up about it. I just think thinking too much about those things is like arranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. It's a waste of energy which you could, you know, use more effectively in leaving an effective life now.
I agree with you completely, although I would say that it's humanly understandable that people want to know, want to have a feeling that they know.
Yeah.
And in my case, I must say, my feeling that I know that there's nothing there.
Yeah. But then also, I think cultivating a sensibility of provisionality is a practice. Cultivating a sense of openness to alternatives, not just settling into the easy yes-no answers, is something that you can cultivate with time. And I think, but going back to science, I think science is a very good example of a method where provisionality is cultivated. So rather than looking for things to confirm what you believe, good science actually tries to falsify and to always be looking for alternatives to challenge your views. Sometimes I think the ethics of science has made greater progress in many ways than other realms of morality. I think that's a good strategy in life, to hold your beliefs lightly. Good scientists do that.
I agree with you completely. I think that being capable of, in one hand, having doubts, understanding that any knowledge is always temporary, and fundamentally, always being curious. Curiosity,
yeah.
I think, is fundamental. It's a fundamental educational value.
Yeah.
Because curiosity means that you are open,
yeah,
to know and understand different things from what you already know. And I think science, its basic tenet, is being open. And there is nothing permanent.
I saw some interesting research recently, Bernardo, that was saying that intelligence and education are no real safeguard against blinkered thinking. What seems to be critical is curiosity. Often intelligent, educated people can actually articulate their way out of dissonance better. So you can justify in a more articulate way often. But people who actually combine that with curiosity, that's where wisdom tends to arise. Curiosity seems to be the root of wisdom.
I agree with you completely. Because curiosity means, basically, that we recognize that what we know is always limited. We can know much better and then change our belief. A curious person is, by definition, a person open to new things. I think the definition of a dogmatic person, religious or not, because you can be dogmatic not being religious, is a person that thinks that he already knows, is putting himself in place of God, because by definition, who knows everything is God.
Yes.
If you are not God, religious or not, therefore, you don't know. You don't know a lot. You don't know enough, and you should always be open to know, to improve, to change. And in this sense, when you ask about Judaism, I think one of the characteristics about, I think Judaism, or you want to say, put it in a more sociological perspective, Jews, because we shouldn't ever confuse individuals with some group characteristics. You can say that some characteristics tend to happen more in one group than another because of historical reasons. For me, it was about learning to live with cognitive dissonance. I think the Jewish experience for 2,000 years, in this very specific sense, I think that only Jews in the diaspora. In Israel, please, I'm not denying that they are Jews, but they don't have one element that is fundamental sociologically in the Jewish experience, that you know that what you think is only a minority that thinks like you, that there is another side that think differently, and you need to accept and understand that they think differently because that is a condition of survival.
Yes.
When you are the majority and you have a minority on your side, you can completely ignore, be depreciative of them because you don't need them. The Jews, at least in the 2,000 years of diasporic experience, in order to survive, they needed to learn to live with cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
You need to keep your own belief in spite that the majority thinks differently. And at the same time, to understand how the majority thinks in order to live together and, you know, continue to be alive.
Yeah.
And for me, this is the Jewish characteristic, although it doesn't mean that all Jews, and even more today, are part of this long-term tradition.
That tension you're talking about sounds very resonant of the middle way, finding that balance between your own values and the values of others. And that brings me to mind another concept that you have spoken about, a polytheism of values, Bernardo. Could you, for the listeners that are not familiar with that, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. In fact, in general, when you speak about polytheism of values, people, especially if you are religious, you say, no, I am monotheist. Please, I am, first of all, basically it's a metaphor. It's a metaphoric concept. But it's not only a metaphoric concept. It is also about to remind us that before monotheist religions took over a major part of the world, in polytheist situations, there was no belief that only one God is the only possible God. In other words, monotheism had an element of totalitarianism. If there is only one God, then any other God is false and then should be eliminated. Then monotheism, I think, had a seat of totalitarianism. In Roman times, Jews and then Christians were called atheists. Why? Because they denied the existence of other gods. But they were officially called atheists.
That's interesting.
Many philosophers called them the Jews and then the Christian atheists, because you don't accept other possible truths. Then I think there is in monotheism, it was historically at least, a potential of totalitarian thinking. Mm-hmm. Because odd is this God or anything else is false. Then I think this is an historical element which I think we should always remember about the negative way in which monotheism was implanted in a very small place that was Israel, and then through the world, through the Roman Empire. Now, what I mean by polytheism value, and I must say that is a concept that some authors did use it, like Max Weber, the social scientist, and he did use it in the sense I'm using, is by recognizing that society isn't ever organized around only one value. De facto, any society always need to survive to have a set of different values. Mm-hmm. And although they may present themselves having one value as being the most important absolute, de facto, what they have, yeah, they can have compassion, they have love, but they have also some type of individualism, self-care, you know, family, community. None of those values can be considered absolute, because it will be destructive for society if you put only one value above the others.
Yeah.
In fact, the religious tradition says, okay, the priest will tell you which is the most important value you need to apply in a given society, or the rabbi. If you have a contradiction between one value and the other, and values are not, we must remember, are not only rational arguments. Values at the same time are rational and emotional unities.
Yeah.
Because values tells you what you need to prioritize, what is more important, which in fact are always related to. You have a value of loving your father, your son, your wife, and in some moments, they can come into contradiction.
Yeah, yeah. Or you could have a value of purity, and that's quite a conservative value. But it's not just conservative. You know, if you've got a dirty river down at the bottom of your garden, that value is going to kick in. But that probably stems from a feeling of disgust that maybe you got from early childhood. These values are very embodied.
Yeah. But again, this element of polytheism. In the Jewish tradition, for instance, Shabbat, yeah, Saturday, should be respected, is one of the most important values.
Yeah.
But if it is about saving a human life, you can cross the purity line and save the person. Then there are always values always contradict in concrete situations.
Yeah, yeah.
And you need to choose. Now, if you do not have a priest or a rabbi to tell you how you should somehow solve the contradiction among values, a free person or a person that wants to be free, because I think freedom is an ideal and not ever a complete reality, you should first of all recognize that we live with a plurality of values.
Yeah.
And freedom, and above all wisdom, is about recognizing that life is about the capacity of living together with different values, and therefore none of them is absolute.
No, that makes a lot of sense again, Bernardo. I have a personal, practical experience with this recently. I'm sure you're aware that in the UK over the last couple of years, we've been in a sort of state, not quite a political revolt, but upheaval with Brexit and elections, etc. And I actually got onto a website called Politics Not Personalities, and on this website they would give you about six or seven policies from all the various parties, whether it be crime or immigration or defence or the economy or whatever. But they wouldn't tell you which party the policy was, so you just had to choose the policy. Anyway, what was very interesting about this was that what it showed you the results that most people are politically, in the UK at least, are bi or tri-conceptual. We're led to think that you are a conservative or you're a socialist or you're a liberal or whatever, but most people have a plurality of values when it comes to their political decisions too. So someone might vote conservative when it comes to crime, but will be quite progressive when it comes to the health service. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that because that seems to tie in with what you're saying.
I think what you are saying is very important because as Latin American, for me, some type of political militancy was very important when I was young and was in this, call it in the socialist, even socialist revolutionary tradition.
Yeah.
And it took me time to understand that, in fact, the best of the political traditions in the 20th century is the social democratic tradition. And what is the social democratic tradition, in a few words? It's basically taking the best of the liberal capitalist tradition and the best of the socialist tradition. And here's the problem with capitalism in the most ultra-liberal sense or with communism. They are monotheistic. They put only one value as the basis to organize society. And then you destroy society because society cannot be built only on the basis of one value, being that individual freedom or egalitarianism. Then with time, and I think this is my middle way to find a way to political participation, is to not accept that any party that pushes too much in one direction has the solution, probably will be destructive. In fact, I think I am putting in words, and you did the same, what most people really think. I think most people, if they were more educated, elaborated in the middle way of thinking, they would understand that they have no complete alliance to any political party, that they accept in part some elements of one party platform and the other party.
Yeah.
But the way that parties need to present themselves for political struggle is to be unilateral.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting. Okay. I should make the point as well that when you talk about the polytheism of values, this is not a recipe for relativism, is it? You're not advocating relativism.
Not at all. I think that we need values. We need to have strong belief in the sense that things that are important for us, you know, social justice, freedom, are basic components in our moral structure, and I think are necessary. The only thing that I'm saying is that in spite of the strong moral values I can have, I always understand that those moral values are situational. The way I handle them will depend a lot on the context, and that other people can present different ideas that I should take in consideration and respect the possibility to defend and advance the ideas, because I know that strong my values can be, they are not absolute and not God-given, and therefore I should be always open to understand and respect other visions.
Yeah.
Therefore, I am not relativistic in relation to myself. I am, call it relativistic in the sense that I understand that there is no ultimate foundation for what I believe.
Okay. And conflict. How do you understand conflict within this framework?
That's a very good question. I think the only conflict in the sense of confrontation that is not based on honest dialogue, but in a situation that you transform politics in war. War not in the sense of military war, but about denying the other side right to be there.
Yeah. Eh?
The legitimacy of the other side. This is the only conflict, because I think conflict is part of human condition, human situation. Life in complex society produce conflict permanently. But I think that this conflict should be solved by pacific means. The point is when you present an argument that denies the other side possibility of existence, you delegitimize. Then for me, conflict is a situation when I confront racism, any type of ways of denying the other the right to existence. And this situation is borderline because I don't have more the tools to confront it. And then there is a philosophical discussion in which moment you should deny persons that present this type of argument or more of practical activity to be in the public space.
Yeah, but like, you know, the dialectic, when you've got synthesis, antithesis, and it's thesis, antithesis, synthesis, haven't you?
Synthesis, that's right.
So is that a form of conflict, that there's a sort of openness and curiosity?
Yeah, I think that conflict is the basis of human nature. Not conflict with the other, it's conflict with yourself. When you say that you accept that human being in society depends on different values which are conflictive between them, who I should prioritize, myself or my family? My family or the needed? Yes. Needed in Brazil or the needed in Ghana or Afghanistan? You know, I think what makes people, and I think should be again is about educating themselves, and is about accepting that conflict is nothing exterior to you.
Yeah.
That conflict is something is inherent to human condition. As we are permanently in conflict with ourselves, what should I do, this or that? Then when you understand that you are in conflict with yourself, you can understand that it's natural that you will be in conflict with other person. And at the same, when you are in conflict with yourself, you don't kill one part of yourself, you accept different parts.
Yeah.
You should also accept that other people have opinions, ideas, that is not what you think. It's about learning to live with conflict. I think is in a great extent the basic idea of politism of values.
I think sometimes there's this perception from many people that conflict is some type of fall from grace in some way, that it's a move away from some ideal state. But I fully agree with you that if you get human beings together, or you know, if within our own heads too, there's going to be conflict, but it's how you deal with that conflict that leads to integration.
I agree with you. I think that, and I'm very far from that, very far, extremely far, unfortunately. I think that wisdom is to be capable of living peacefully with conflict.
What a great definition, yeah.
I think it's about that.
Yeah, I'll remember that.
But this is something that one should all the time cultivate inside ourselves, because conflict, of course, produces sometimes anxiety, frustration, and so on. But if you don't, I think this is the only starting point about living together and supporting yourself.
Yeah. Okay, we're just coming near to the end now, Bernardo, and it's a question I always ask people in these interviews. We've been touching on the middle way, but I'd just like to ask you, what is your understanding of the middle way in relation to what we've been talking about today?
I think the middle way, it is a form, an expression, and it's an excellent way to put wisdom as the basis of our life. Because I think the middle way is about wisdom. It's not about a answer concrete answer to any problem. It's about approaching problems, approaching experience of learning. And in this sense, I would say identify. And I think it has a long tradition, both in Buddhist and in Greek philosophy.
Yeah, very much so.
Which became, I think, with some polarizations, first of all, through monotheistic tradition, and then some political ideologies, has been demoralized. But Aureus Mediocritas, it was the golden rule of people's life in the Greco-Roman Empire, and it seems should be again, is the only way to go forward, because unfortunately the world today is polarizing in very dogmatic, self-centered positions, which is going to be extremely destructive.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Bernardo. It's been an absolute pleasure and very, very interesting. Thank you.
My pleasure, Barry. All the best. Keep going and let's keep in touch.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.